Welcome to the All Sides Reporter Roundtable, a show where we catch you up on the political news of last week and preview the week ahead. I'm your host, Anna Staver. Joining me on this special 11 a.m. hour of the Reporter Roundtable is Cleveland.com Statehouse reporter Andrew Tobias, who covered the Republican National Convention in Milwaukee last week. Welcome back, Andrew.
It's good to be here.
I hope you've slept.
I have, yes.
At least until Sunday. And also at the table is Jake Zuckerman, state politics and policy reporter for Cleveland.com. Welcome back, Jake.
Thank you for having me on.
And making his debut on the Reporter Roundtable is Shane Stegmiller, a reporter for Hannah News Service. Welcome to All Sides.
Good morning. Thanks for the invite.
Heck of a week to start.
Yes.
The shakeup of the Democratic presidential ticket is reshaping the race. I had planned to talk about the newly minted Republican VP, J.D. Vance, who is back in Ohio. He's speaking in his hometown of Middleton later this afternoon. But first, let's talk about Biden getting out of the race and what the reaction has been here in Ohio. So, Andrew, everyone from, you know, Senator Sherrod Brown to Greg Landsman down to Dontavious Gerald has said they back Harris. I don't think I've heard anybody yet say they back somebody else.
Yeah, and I think that window has closed at this point with all of the sort of most viable candidates also backing Harris at a national level. So I think Democrats are going to be really eager to present a unified front on this kind of after the events of the last month or so, where they've been basically spending the entire time arguing with each other online. So that's, I think that, you know, that's likely to continue. And then, you know, from Republicans, it's very similar to what national Republicans are saying. And it's basically like, oh, I thought this was the party of democracy, and now they're going to, you know, push the guy who got millions of votes in the primary out the door. So, which, you know, people can doubt the sincerity of that kind of, you know, given like the moment. But yeah, it's basically those two buckets, and we're not really seeing a lot of deviation from that from the two parties.
You know, Governor Mike DeWine was posting on the social media site known as X Sunday, noting that he and Biden were colleagues in the U.S. Senate and they served on the Senate Judiciary Committee. He posted that Fran and I wish President Biden and the First Lady all the best as he serves out the remainder of his term in the years ahead. Very statesmanlike statement, Jake.
It is very statesmanlike, and it stands in pretty sharp contrast to people like J.D. Vance saying, you know, if Joe Biden is stepping down from the campaign, therefore he must resign from the presidency, which is a pretty grave, not grave, but pretty serious thing to lob out there. So it's just a stunning contrast, I suppose.
Yeah. And Shane, you know, U.S. Senator Sherrod Brown on Friday called on President Biden to drop out of the race. It was expected that we would hear more people, more senators this week. So, I mean, I don't know. Does this mean anything for Brown's reelection campaign?
No.
Probably way too soon to tell. Anyway.
It is too soon. Brown, I think, had to make a statement at some point. Moreno, who's his opponent, was going out of his way to try and paint the issues with Biden to Brown. And there was a whole coordinated social media and other places of why is Sherrod Brown being silent on whether or not Joe Biden should stay in the campaign. So this was, he at some point had to say something. And that's where he came down finally, was to call for him to step out.
And so we also can't talk about this momentous and truly historic, I'm getting tired of saying the word historic, but truly historic decision without talking about Ohio and when our deadline to have somebody on the ballot is. Because, Andrew, there's been a lot of conversation about August 7th, September 1st, about lawsuits. Like, can you walk us through what's going on here?
So the topic that we've been talking about the most throughout this year is the August 7 deadline that you referenced. And basically in state law, it says that if you're a major party and you want to nominate a presidential candidate, that this is the deadline by which you must do that. And when the Democratic National Convention was scheduled after that date, we had months of really fun kind of legislative back and forth and questions about whether Republican lawmakers would essentially fix that problem as they have in years past when it's presented a similar conflict. They met, they did, they passed a law. And so when Republicans have been asked about this topic, Attorney General Dave Yost at the RNC last week, I and some other reporters were talking to him, and he got asked, is this going to be a problem? And he basically said, I cannot envision a single scenario under which the Democratic presidential nominee will not appear on the ballot. And that was at a time before Biden had dropped out, but when it was kind of clearly, you know, a plausible possibility. We had Frank LaRose, the Secretary of State, essentially say something similar yesterday while also saying like, I was right about this. I pointed it out. So, you know, Democrats, you can thank me later. I was listening to your previous hour, and David Pepper, I think, the former chairman of the Democratic Party, made a good point in that our system does contemplate a scenario where perhaps a presidential candidate may die or otherwise become incapacitated. I don't think it's reasonable to think that we would just have a blank spot in the ballot and the Republican would win by default, you know, and sort of whatever the candidate would be. So this is important to think about. You know, we'll see whether or not it prompts a lawsuit, but we've had Republicans in Ohio on the record saying they don't think that it's an issue.
State Senator Bill DeMora told the Columbus Dispatch that he doubts Democrats will do a virtual roll call now. Jake, what do you think? Are we gonna do that early? Because that was one of the things that came up when we were fighting over the deadline here in Ohio. Democrats were like, we'll just do an early roll call ahead of that August 7th deadline, and it'll all be good to go. Do you think they do the roll call? Do you think they wait for the convention? I can't decide which one makes sense now that Harris may be the nominee.
Well, if the last month has taught anything, it's never predict anything in presidential politics. I'm loath to even take the question, but here I go. I want to say it wouldn't be a virtual, digital, online. That just sounds like kind of a low energy and disjointed and just not tangible way to chart the future right now. But that's what the path as of 2 weeks ago, so maybe, I don't know. So,
well, I can say why I'm doubtful, although maybe, you know, like there's tens of thousands of Biden-Harris campaign t-shirts that kind of have evidence to why we shouldn't make predictions, like Jake said. But they have to pick a vice presidential nominee, and there's going to be questions about this process that Republicans are going to flame. And even, you know, Harris is going to be confronted with questions like, did you know that when what many Americans saw on the debate when Biden, you know, appeared to not have his fastball like he used to? And so she's going to face questions about whether, you know, did you cover this up or something like that? So I think they're going to want to really lend legitimacy to the process. And I don't think doing an online convention that's kind of hurriedly, you know, thrown together after this event, you know, I just don't think that would be in the service of that. So I'd be very surprised if they move forward with it.
Yeah. You know, U.S. Representative Chantel Brown of Cleveland has posted her support for Harris. Representative Joyce Beatty here in Columbus said it's go time. Amelia Sykes of Akron said we need leaders who are looking to the future. Marcy Kaptur says I deeply respect his selfless decision. It's, you know, Shane, it's pretty unanimous here in the state that they, like, a lot, everybody that I'm hearing from say it's Harris. It's Harris all the way.
It seems to be that everybody's going to coalesce around Harris. That's probably a way to try and get around the chaos of having your nominee.
And who has rights to campaign cash?
Exactly. It's going to be so much easier to transfer everything over to Harris versus having a new nominee step in, having them to have to start from day one, start from scratch. They have to put together a campaign team. They have to put together a campaign team in each state. This makes it the
Harris
easiest.
Kind of just inherits the money, the entire infrastructure. There's a lot of advantages to that. Her name is on the campaign, filings.
And because her name is on the campaign, it's my understanding she can just access that immediately.
Although there may be a lawsuit about whether she has the right to access that, but who knows? You know, Andrew, you heard J.D. Vance speak at the convention on last Wednesday. Can't believe that's only been a handful of days since that happened. What was it like there in the moment, and how do you think he's going to pivot? I mean, he's having his first campaign event now, and Biden is no longer the nominee.
He did dedicate the parts of his speech to criticizing Joe Biden. There was a segment of the speech in which he kind of recounted how when I forget the exact chronology, but when he was in middle school, Joe Biden was voting for NAFTA. When he was in high school or whatever the years of J.D. Vance's academic career lineup.
Been a politician longer than I've been alive.
Yeah, voting for the Iraq War. And so overall, the speech, though, you know, Vance has developed an instinct over the past 2 years or more in the public eye recently as just kind of like pushing the button anytime there's an opportunity to say something that, you know, that is inflammatory. If people are mad about something on the right, then he'll lean into that. And he notably did not repeat his criticism or his view that that Biden's rhetoric somehow contributed to the assassination attempt that
nobody
occurred.
At the RNC really mentioned that. They were very careful to skirt around it directly.
Yeah, and that was, they were trying to present kind of, you know, the way they described that is trying to turn down the temperature and also kind of call for unity and that kind of thing. So, but yeah, he did lay out a vision for the Republican Party that's pretty different than even like 10 years ago. He's talking about how, big corporations have let down, small town America. He insisted also, which was, I thought was interesting, that he said that America isn't just a set of ideas, but it's a place that we have to defend physically, kind of like this concept of the nation state. So there's a lot packed into it, but besides all the stuff I just rattled off, he also just kind of gave his life story. He talked about his...
It was an introduction.
Yes, exactly.
And what was the reaction from, like, the Ohio delegation? What was the vibe being in the room?
So, honestly, I think that they're just really excited that Ohio's relevant in
they're just
space.
Happy to be here.
Yeah, like, that sounds kind of silly to say, but the chairman of the Republican Party, Alex Tranofilou, the phrase he used, like, we're back in the mix again. There's this worry that if, a lot of people in politics who are involved with it came up in, a period when Ohio was just the quintessential swing state. And while Republicans, I'm sure, like to win elections, the people who are in the party are maybe kind of wistful about the idea of not being competitive anymore. You don't get as much attention. You don't get as much money. So I honestly think they're just excited to have one of their own, on the ticket this year. That's really my view.
And, Jake, myself, and Shane, we all were probably watching it remotely. What have you both been hearing? And I can start with you, Jake, about the reaction to J.D. Vance's speech here in Ohio.
I know. My sense just from watching the speech, and yeah, it was, it was on TV like the rest of the country, but there was a lot of energy and a lot of confidence in that room. And obviously, this was before Joe Biden had dropped out.
He looked pretty confident up there.
He looked confident up there, but as I was watching it, I really struggled to imagine a DNC, which at that point was going to be an online event. And how do you replicate this kind of energy and this kind of confidence? And maybe that speaks to why Joe Biden made the decision he did. But that was really more than any of the actual rhetoric from Vance was just the vibes of the day.
Yeah, up until Trump took the stage, because he spoke for 93 minutes, and we're going to talk a little bit about Trump's speech later this hour, but it was a very tightly run, very on-message RNC. Marjorie Taylor Greene got up and gave a very stereotypical RNC stump speech. I was really surprised by that. She was very on-message, and she's somebody who is absolutely a firebrand for the Republican Party.
I did not watch Marjorie Taylor Greene's speech.
It was remarkable that even heading into the RNC, there was this public debate about the abortion platform. That's a major
segment. Right, they took it out.
Yeah, that's a major segment of the Republican Party is the pro-life wing. And yeah, they took it out of the platform. We saw a lot of those groups start to mobilize. And then I think the shooting, whether maybe it would have happened anyways, but particularly with that, it just completely kind of changed the mood among the delegates. And so, yeah, they're very disciplined. They're very unified. They're excited about the whole thing. So, yes. Yeah, I agree with you.
That was Cleveland.com State House reporter Andrew Tobias. Coming up, reaction to Trump's convention speech and how Ohio might choose a new senator if Vance becomes the VP. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Here at Shortwave Space Camp, we escape our everyday lives to explore the mysteries and quirks of the universe. We find weird, fun, interesting stories that explain how the cosmos is partying all around us. From stars to dwarf planets to black holes and beyond, we've got you. Listen now to the Shortwave podcast from NPR.
You're listening to the Weekly Reporter Roundtable here on All Sides, where we talk all things Ohio politics. I'm your host, Anna Staver. Today, we're discussing the big story of the week, really the big story of the year, President Biden's withdrawal from the presidential race and how that decision is playing out. Still with us is Cleveland.com State House reporter Andrew Tobias, Jake Zuckerman, state politics and policy reporter for Cleveland.com, and Shane Stegmiller, a reporter for Hannah News Service. On Friday, I really thought that we'd all be sitting here talking about the RNC, about Ohio's junior senator becoming the nominee for vice president, and about former President Donald Trump recounting his failed assassination attempt.
All right. I started to, like this, turn to my right and was ready to begin a little bit further turn, which I'm very lucky I didn't do, when I heard a loud whizzing sound and felt something hit me really, really hard on my right ear. I said to myself, wow, what was that? It can only be a bullet. And moved my right hand to my ear, brought it down. My hand was covered with blood, just absolutely blood all over the place. I immediately knew it was very serious, that we were under attack, and in one movement proceeded to drop to the ground. Bullets were continuing to fly as very brave Secret Service agents rushed to the stage.
Andrew, you were in Milwaukee. What was it like when he was recounting that story? Because I felt like the entire convention, you could almost hear a pin drop as he was telling that.
Yeah, it was totally silent. And I thought it was sort of funny when he mentioned that the rally happened in Pennsylvania and the Pennsylvania delegation cheered. And it's kind of like, okay, guys, like, read the room, you know. But, you know, absent that, I mean, the atmosphere to me reminded me of a church service or something, which, you know, like one of those, you know, kind of mega church, like evangelical type things. It was a big crowd. There's a lot of emotion. He went and the firefighter, or the retired fire chief, rather, who was shot and killed sort of as a bystander, they had his uniform on the stage. Trump went over and kissed the helmet. There were people crying. It was a very emotional and a very, you know, rapt audience, because he hadn't really spoken about it publicly before.
We'd all been waiting to hear what he was going to say.
Yeah.
And then he spoke of unity, of being the president of all Americans, not just half of America. And then he went off script, and we got the greatest hits. We got the Trump, like, stump speeches. What was the atmosphere like there after he spoke, the balloons dropped, like, the whole party was over?
So there were kind of two things I'll say about that. One is that because it was like a greatest hits, these are a bunch of Trump delegates. They were excited to hear his criticisms of, you know, crazy Nancy Pelosi, or insert, you know, your favorite Trump talking point here. But I mean, he told the story about taking credit for redesigning a naval carrier or something. He
mentioned Hannibal Lecter.
Yeah, like, it was the end of a long week. You know, I and some other people were there from the Eastern time zone, so it felt an hour later than it was. He'd been talking for a really long time, and people got kind of listless. They were looking at their phones. So he did go on for a really long time. And so, yeah, I mean, at some point, I think he kind of lost the thread a little bit and lost the crowd a little bit, too.
You know, conventions are typically a place where people hoping to be the future of the party get to test their messages on a national stage. And one of those speakers was Vivek Ramaswamy, the Ohio businessman who ran for president against Donald Trump and then endorsed him. Like J.D. Vance, Vivek spoke about his personal narrative. And in Vivek's case, he's the child of immigrants.
Our message to every legal immigrant in this country is this. You're like my parents. You deserve the opportunity to secure a better life for your children in America. But our message to illegal immigrants is also this. We will return you to your country of origin, not because you're all bad people, but because you broke the law. And the United States of America was founded on the rule of law.
Jake, what do you think is next for Vivek Ramaswamy? Because it sounds like he's running for something. I just don't know what.
Yeah, I think running for something is just the way to put it. Maybe there is nothing specific. You know, maybe he wants to be appointed to the Senate. Maybe he's just keeping his options open. But yeah, that sounds like someone with an agenda, the way he's talking there. I do want to come back to one thing that Andrew said that I think he nailed with the church-like element of Trump's speech at the RNC. I got very revivalist vibes at one point when Trump said something like, I'm not supposed to be here. And then the audience, and you saw people crying. Like, I mean, I know I saw tears in the crowd, and people were yelling, "Yes, you are!" And it became like a refrain, and everyone's, "Yes, you are!" And that really just had a Southern Baptist feeling to it.
You know, Shane, Vivek is hoping, I think in some ways, to be the future of politics here. I hate to be talking about 2026 and beyond or 2028, but I don't know. Do you see him running for governor? I feel like that's maybe not what he wants. I feel like maybe he'd want the U.S. Senate seat if Vance is VP. I don't know. I don't know what he wants.
I would not rule out anything. It seemed to be he was trying to raise his profile more than anything else. He seems to be interested in the Senate seat, most definitely. There's also ramblings that if Trump is elected, he wants some
cabinet
major
position.
Role in the cabinet. So he's leaving
his options
open. And I think he was more just trying to raise his profile than anything.
Yeah, he's young, too. I believe he's 38. He's like a year or two younger than J.D. Vance. So he has a long time, I suppose, in a world where 78-year-olds are still running for office. He's got a lot of years left. Another potential future candidate that we saw sing a song, Andrew, was Attorney General Dave Yost.
Yeah, that was a highlight for me of the week. As somebody who's been observing Dave Yost kind of like armchair musical career for a while now, there probably was a discussion on his team about whether it was sort of tonally appropriate given kind of the whole, you know, proximity of the shooting and stuff like that. But he basically said, like, look, we're here for the week, like, we have to have a little bit of fun. He went up on a piano and he played a rendition of old time rock and roll that he'd repurposed. You know, the first line was "Take the old Biden off the shelf," you know, for example. So, there's another thing that, you know, he also had produced for the event, a set of euchre cards that had the face cards were replaced with different Republican officials. The jokers were Kamala Harris and Joe Biden, if that kind of like gives you an idea. So this is like very classic politics, kind of corny
political theater.
Yeah, exactly. And it was he was there, you know. I think he's cognizant of the fact that Dave Yost is planning to run for governor in 2026, and it's an opportunity to kind of get noticed and make an impression on the delegates who are going to be the kinds of people that you need to win over in order to win a Republican primary.
And another potential candidate, or actually is a candidate for governor in 2026, is the current lieutenant governor, John Husted. He introduced J.D. Vance on the first night when he was nominated to the convention, and he gave this speech to the Ohio delegation during the RNC that really sounded like a campaign speech for governor.
You can't do Made in America without Made in Ohio, because we make the things that people need to live and thrive every day. And we talk about Ohio being the heart of it all. The governor, Governor DeWine, brought back that slogan for Ohio, the heart of it all. Isn't it the right theme for Ohio? Because here's the deal. From the food you eat, to the cars you drive, to the trucks that deliver, to the airplanes that fly, to the cloud that connects us all, and the chips that power our devices, that's what we do in Ohio. We make the things that people need. We have working people here. We fight for the heart and soul of our country. The defense industry is headquartered in Ohio. That's the heart and soul of who we are. And we know this. Donald Trump and J.D. Vance can't do Made in America without Made in Ohio.
Shane, that sounds like a gubernatorial speech if I've ever heard one.
He's been running for governor for a while. You remember he did run for governor in 2018 before he joined up with Mike DeWine. Not too long ago, he separated himself from the DeWine campaign, started his own campaign finance fund. He's been laying the groundwork for a long time to run for governor. It is not surprising that he is running for governor. He hasn't officially announced it, but it would be more surprising if he didn't run for governor.
So essentially, John Husted wants to be governor and water is wet.
Yes, and sometimes the sky is blue, yes.
Yeah, I think it really is. Conventions traditionally are where we audition the next generation of leaders. Who gets to speak? Bernie Moreno also gave a short speech on Tuesday night, I think, right, Andrew? He went with a whole slate of Senate candidates.
Yeah, and that kind of speaks to how, you know, there are a bunch of seats up for grabs this year. Republicans could retake control of the Senate, and so they want to use it as an opportunity. You know, I don't know who's dialing in or watching the RNC at 7 on a Tuesday night, but if nothing else, you know, it's stuff that the candidates can cut into clips that they can put on the internet or in fundraising things. You know, sometimes a speech goes really well. they really do introduce themselves to a broader audience. But yeah, it's basically a dry run, and it's also we have had instances of obscure politicians like Barack Obama in 2004 having a really great speech and kind of kicking off a lot. But yeah, it's whether it's to a national audience or whether it's just to the Republicans who are attending the convention, these things are indeed auditions for the future generation of leaders.
And if the crazy news cycle from the last 8 days has made you feel like you need a drink, why not do it with us here at WOSU? You can join me and Mike Thompson on Thursday, August 15th at 6 p.m. We'll be hosting Politics in a Pint at Seven Suns Brewing on North 4th Street. Stay for the, you know, come for the beer, stay for the politics. It will be August 15th at 6 p.m. To register, go to WOSU.org/events. So I want to pivot a little bit, Shane, and talk a little bit about some state house news and voting challenges. So All Voting is Local and Common Cause are asking the Secretary of State to stop letting outside groups challenge who can vote in Ohio. The groups say that these challenges are under the guise of election integrity. In Lincoln County, for example, 500 registered voters were challenged. What is going on here?
This is part of a national movement kind of following out of some of the questions that people have been raising about the 2020 election. There's been this narrative that there are people who are voting who shouldn't be. So there's some groups going around and they're taking it upon themselves to challenge who they think people who are not eligible to vote. So these groups, the Common Cause and All Voting is Local, they sent a letter to the Secretary of State saying, you know, you need to come out, you need to issue some guidance, you need to tell boards of elections what they need to do if these groups approach them, because you have Hamilton County had one challenge of a voter that they said they went for an hour and then the board dismissed the challenge. You had Licking County that they said was agreeing to work with this group, and they questioned whether or not that would run afoul of the law that the state passed that says you can't work with outside groups aimed at the so-called Zuckerbucks, where Mark Zuckerberg, the founder of Facebook, one of his nonprofits, was giving states money to help with like voter turnout issues and that. So they're saying, and they said, we don't even know what's going on in some of these other counties. These are just the ones we know about. So they're asking the Secretary of State's office to step in, issue a directive, say this is what you can and can't do. I asked them, I said, are you going to file a legal challenge if these groups keep working with boards of elections? And they said, well, we're not really litigious, but there may be other groups that, you know, we work with, and I'm guessing like the ACLU.
That sounds about right.
Would maybe take them to court. So it might be something we see pop up.
You know, Jake, speaking of voter rolls, Secretary Frank LaRose has also come under a little bit of heat for the way he cleans the voter rolls here in Ohio.
Yeah, I mean, I think that these two things are really related. My understanding of what this Election Integrity Network is doing is sending the names of voters that ought to be purged. And I couldn't really speak to the law. Is this legal? Are boards of election, are they allowed to be working in concert with these kinds of groups? But I think there's a bigger question if you're, why are these people doing this? You know, an idle voter registration, even if it meets the legal qualifications to be purged, it's not hurting anyone. So I think that there's, especially after what we saw with a pretty coordinated and sustained effort to delegitimize the election, I think that this is a sign that it would be foolish to think that that's a thing of the past. I mean, there are still, this smells to me like something you do to point to smoke, if not fire, about an election of saying, oh, why didn't County X purge these 500 names that we sent them? They're asleep at the wheel. So I would like to know more about who these people are and what are their intentions. I spoke to Aaron Ackerman who represents the county boards of election. He's saying it is not just Licking County. These are everywhere. I mean, these are all over the place. They're all getting these letters. This is a coordinated thing. This isn't just some weird thing happening in Licking County.
And I just wanted to add in that according to the groups that are raising this issue, the people that they are flagging aren't these people that are going to be removed through the secretary's normal process of
removing.
This is a different process. These are an addition to those people that have been flagged for possible removal because they haven't voted in a few federal elections.
And I will say, if you end up being purged, if you discover that, you can re-register to vote. You have, you can re-register to vote all the way up until, what is it, October? And that's when we cut it off. I'm not sure of the exact date, so I don't want to give you guys an exact date. But as long as you get registered by end of September, you should be good to go and vote in the November election, even if you have been purged from the rolls. Switching to speculation about who might get J.D. Vance's seat should he become the vice president. Because we've been talking a lot in the last hour about who Kamala Harris might pick for her VP. Andrew, in a world where J.D. Vance becomes the vice president, he leaves his Senate seat. Governor Mike DeWine gets to appoint somebody. And then in 2026, correct, we would have another Senate election to have a run at it. But whoever it is then will be the senator for 18-ish months.
Yeah, and that's a pretty important thing. Even if they don't end up winning the election in 2026, it's a long time to serve in one of the handful of seats that are going to represent the Senate, but also potentially be a swing vote if Republicans end up winning control of the Senate, too. So I had looked into this before. This had occurred to people as a possibility when J.D. Vance was kind of on the short list to be the vice presidential nominee for the Republicans. But when it actually happened, Republicans were feeling pretty good about their chances about a week ago. I kind of took another pass at asking DeWine about this. And at the convention, I don't think this literally happened, but Mike DeWine's in an elevator and somebody puts their hand in the door who wants to be appointed to the Senate and gets in there, for a couple minutes. There was open lobbying happening. We'd actually, Vivek Ramaswamy floated his own name for the appointment publicly, although he said, like we were discussing earlier, he'd also think about doing a Trump cabinet role if that were to be presented.
Wherever he could serve best, I think was right. The line.
I'm trying to think how specific I can get. Yeah, so for example, I had one politically active delegate tell me they wanted Jane Timken to be appointed to the seat.
She ran for it in 2022, didn't make it out of the primary.
Right, and there's people actively lobbying for her. That person also told me that a couple of congressmen are interested in the seat. I talked to a couple of congressmen.
Another special election.
Yeah, and
that's musical chairs.
Oh yeah, exactly. But Jim Jordan and Warren Davidson, who I'm just picking them out because I saw them. I think they're either keeping their options open or they're focused on this election, whatever kind of the verbiage is they chose to use to deflect the question. But yeah, I could keep going.
Yeah, there's
on,
also Secretary of State Frank LaRose ran and lost. State Senator Matt Dolan, who DeWine endorsed in the last primary, where Bernie Moreno ended up winning. So there's a laundry list of people who might fancy themselves a Senate seat.
And I do want to say, too, that DeWine did kind of expound about what he's looking for in this as he's considering it. So he does want somebody who wants to hold the seat after the 2026 election. So not some a caretaker kind of rules that out. He wants to be able to win not only a primary but a general election. So somebody who can both appeal to somebody who loves Donald Trump and also your suburban mom in the November election swing voter kind of thing. And then he also said that he has some ideas about how people should operate in the Senate, having been there himself. And so you can sort of read that for whatever that is. But DeWine is talking openly about both the lobbying and also the criteria that he's considered as he's fielding these requests.
Coming up, we're moving on from the presidential race to catch you up on the statehouse news that you might have missed amidst all this national chaos. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Here at Shortwave Space Camp, we escape our everyday lives to explore the mysteries and quirks of the universe. We find weird, fun, interesting stories that explain how the cosmos is partying all around us. From stars to dwarf planets to black holes and beyond, we've got you. Listen now to the Shortwave podcast from NPR.
You're listening to the All Sides Weekly Reporter Roundtable. I'm your host, Anna Staver. Still with us is Hannah News Service reporter Shane Stegmiller, Andrew Tobias, Statehouse reporter for Cleveland.com, and Jake Zuckerman, State Politics and Policy reporter for Cleveland.com. Jake, you wrote about the other big news of the week that sort of got lost in all of this, which is that Republican lawmakers say it's time to bring iGaming and iLottery to our smartphones. This kind of betting has been off limits in Ohio so far. So is this the future of gaming in Ohio?
Yeah, I mean, not even the committee that was appointed to study that question even really clearly answered it. This all comes back to the last state budget when Ohio doubled its tax on sports betting, and that ruffled a lot of feathers. You know, there was a lot of long-term interest in that, and all of a sudden the tax rate doubled. There were some, is this a good way to go about making policy? There were some one-off attempts to fiddle with the tax rate, and the consensus was, let's just start a study committee that comprehensively looks at gambling policy in Ohio. And that study committee quickly turned into requests from the industry to move things in this and that direction. There's a push to legalize iGaming, which would be like blackjack, poker, those kinds of things on your phone. There's a push to legalize iLottery, so buying a lottery ticket on your phone instead of at a gas station. And the committee members, I mean, if you're familiar with like the judicial process, this was more like a Supreme Court opinion with 9 dissents and concurrences that agreed in part. I mean, it was just all over the map. I guess a plurality said, yes, it's time, especially with iLottery, there seems to be stronger support because right now it's not quite a lottery sale online, but there are vendors out there that basically buy a ticket for you and you can buy it digitally and they act as a custodian almost.
It's sort of a recognition of that we're already here.
Yeah, yeah, I'd call it a gray area, but they seem I've to seen be ads operating legally. Yeah, lotto.com. And then other states have just made a lot of money. Like Michigan has made a lot of money, a lot of tax revenue by legalizing iGaming. So I think there's some arguments festering like, well, what's the real difference? You know, you let betting on sports, what's the argument for not allowing something like blackjack? But again, the committee was all over the map. There were some members who had concerns about problem gaming. Not a whole lot of appetite to touch the tax rate, as it seems like. I think a lot less appetite on iGaming than iLottery. So yeah, it's hard to give a clean answer to that, but at least safe to say there is some interest in moving on both those fronts.
I have to imagine the brick and mortar gaming facilities like the casinos are pushing back on this pretty forcefully against sort of iGaming, at least.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. And that, you know, it's a little rich hearing some of the problem gambling arguments from the casino industry. But yeah, I think that there's some tension between some of the national operators that operate the digital books versus, you know, your Planet Hollywood, like the actual brick and mortar casinos, like you mentioned.
Shane, on Friday, backers of a proposed qualified immunity constitutional amendment that would end certain restrictions against suing officers who fire their weapons in the line of duty. Attorney General Dave Yost has rejected their petition to get on the ballot 9 times. So can you give us a refresher on what's going on and where we are in the legal fight to maybe get this amendment on the ballot?
So to kind of just give a quick to the process of how it works is if you want to put something on the ballot, you can't just go out and start collecting signatures to put something on the ballot. You have to go through a process. So you have to submit a lot of times when you're putting out the petitions, you have like a summary of this is what the amendment will do. Well, you have to submit it to the Attorney General. The Attorney General has to look at it and says, okay, this is accurate. This is faithfully describing what is actually in the amendment. This group is trying to put this amendment on the ballot, and it would kind of get rid of some of these protections. And they keep submitting their language to the Attorney General, and he keeps rejecting it for various reasons. The most recent time, he rejected it because it didn't have a title. Previously, he rejected it because he didn't like the way the title read. He didn't think that accurately had portrayed what was in the amendment.
Over and over and over again.
So the group has gone the legal route. They first went to the Ohio Supreme Court. Earlier this year, the Ohio Supreme Court refused to expedite and speed up the lawsuit so they could try and get on the ballot this year. They did that without even saying anything. They just rejected it outright. They turned to federal court. They got up to the appeals court in a 2-1 decision. The appeals court, the Sixth Circuit, which covers Ohio, ordered him to move it along to the next point in the process, saying that he's violating their First Amendment. Dave Yost then turned and filed a motion which asks the full court, the full appeals court, to look at it, which was agreed to. That is supposed to be heard in October. So the group, a couple weeks ago, earlier this month, filed a new petition. Last week, Yoast rejected it again for not having a title. So on Friday, they filed a new lawsuit in the Ohio Supreme Court asking for him to forward it on, asking for it to be sped up again because they want to try and get on the 2025 ballot. And in their arguments in the lawsuit they filed, they're saying that there is no scenario that Yoast will approve their amendment, so therefore they need the courts to step in.
What's wild about this, Andrew, is that we're just fighting for the right to go collect signatures. Like, this is, there is no conversation about whether they can get them, because that's no easy feat. This is just a fight to collect the signatures in the first place.
Yeah, and I've been following this story despite the very, the complex twists and turns that Shane just laid out really well, because I don't think this group is, if it were to, I'm just going to peg it, if they were to appear on the ballot, I think this would be a really hard sell to an electorate. I don't know that they have the resources to do that, but this all matters because the arguments that they're waging basically have to do with whether these types of amendments can get on the ballot in the first place. We've had Dave Yoast in the relatively recent past, when we had the abortion rights and marijuana issues last year, did something that attorney generals haven't done in the past, and that's laid out his view of what he thought that those ballot issues would do. He's clearly shown interest in playing a greater role in this process, and so this is kind of like a trial balloon about, you know, how, what kinds of amendments is he going to block, for what reasons, will these groups be successful at pushing them through anyways, and I, especially after we had those ballot issues passed last year, I think we're just going to have more of these types of things. So this is just really like, it's kind of a milestone for this type of issue in general. I'm interested to see where it eventually ends up if we ever get through the legal process at all.
Yeah, it could take a while.
There is one way that a lot of groups have gotten around a hesitant or even opposed attorney general before. Sometimes you can just print the whole amendment itself as your summary. That gets a little more difficult, though, when you have a very complex and long amendment.
And
I'm not sure if that's an option in this case.
The redistricting amendment, for example, is, what, 33, 35 pages, something like that? So, yeah, they went with a summary just for efficiency's sake. You can't if it's long and complicated, you can't exactly fit that into a paragraph. And I also kind of wonder, you know, Jake, how much people really read that. They, you know, when somebody, I think we've all been approached by someone with a petition asking us to sign, and they kind of quickly tell you about it. I don't know how many people read the full summary.
Yeah, I think redistricting is a little easier to break down. Have fun trying with qualified immunity. I mean, that's...
It is. I know. It's one of those... You got to sit with it for a moment and be like, okay, well, this is the special protection that police officers have when they're involved in shootings. And we want to eliminate some of that in these circumstances, but not in this circumstance. And I'm like, yeah, that gets tricky. I don't know what the 30-second ad is for that one. But it is not my job to figure that out. And Jake, I want to talk about one more election-related thing, and that is the Dominion voting machines case. So last week, the Ohio Supreme Court decided that a case involving executive session and Dominion voting machines in Stark County has to go back to a trial court. And they laid out a new standard on what public bodies may do in private discussion. So what the heck happened here?
Yeah, so go back to December of 2020, and this is when Joe Biden has been, you know, projected by the networks as the winner. And as we all pretty painfully learned around then, how, like, the actual mechanics of an election play out. But this is when there was a lot of crazy talk in the air about Dominion and their machines stealing the election and Hugo Chavez. And none of this was true, but it was everywhere. It was up and down the Republican Party. And county boards of election actually have, they don't execute the purchases, but they have discretion over election hardware. And they sent a purchase order to the Stark County Commission saying, we need new Dominion machines. They've been our vendor for 13 years. Things have been good. We haven't had any problems. And the county commission blocked that purchasing order. And the resolution kind of said, well, a lot of people are asking questions and there are these unspecified doubts in the air, so we're just not going to let this happen. So first there was a lawsuit to force the county commission to do its duty, its legal duty here, and carry out this purchase. But then meanwhile, a group called Look Ahead America, which is, let's see, it's one of its principal officers is a figure who's aligned with a lot of Republican congressional candidates, a lot of outside Republican groups, and it has someone else named Matthew Brainerd, who its CEO, who is looking for justice for January 6 prisoners. That's a direct quote from him. and pushing quote-unquote election integrity effort. You know, a lot of the stuff that was really emanating from the conspiracy theories around the 2020 election, they're saying that this board discussed this agreement to make these purchases in private session, and they went into private session and they emerged and said, look, these machines are 99.99% error-free, and this group is saying, well, what did you guys talk about? What are these 0.01 percentage of errors that you talked about in executive session? So the legal issue is ostensibly about when can a board meet in private to talk about certain things. And, you know, that's the sort of thing we can leave to the lawyers here. But the real takeaway is that they're still very literally litigating the 2020 election in Stark County, and now there will be a new trial.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. The new trial will likely happen after the 2024 election, given the timeline here.
Maybe during.
Oh, right at the time that we might be having another conversation about election integrity and who is the winner of the 2024 election.
I would suggest that that is no accident. This is no, the purchase is done. You know, the money's gone. The machines are purchased. So you can't really accomplish anything. And, you know, you can, I know Gannett Media, which owns some of the newspapers in Ohio, did take a position in the case for broader, you know, more restrictive uses of executive session. You could understand their interest there. But I think that this isn't really about the points of law when it comes to executive session.
You know, for those who love to talk about politics like we all do here at the Roundtable, Politics in a Pint is back. We're going to host another edition of our popular event that combines politics and craft beer. And you can join me and WOSU's Mike Thompson on Thursday, August 15th. It's going to be at 6 p.m. at 7th Sun Brewing on North Fort Street. Joining us in the discussion is going to be Karen Kassler from the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau and Natalie Fahmy, State House reporter for NBC4. If you want to register to talk politics over a pint, go to WOSU.org/events. And guys, we're coming to the end of our hour together. I am tempted to ask you what great historic moment will happen between now and the November election, but I hate to be a predictor. Instead, I want to ask you, where do you think Vance goes next? Andrew, he's here in Middletown today laying out his strategy. Do you think he lives in Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan for the next 4 months?
I mean, you choose J.D. Vance because you want him to talk to those three states that you mentioned. So, yes, I think that they're going to, I mean, he's going to North Carolina too today to, you know, kind of in the Appalachian area of that state. But I think he's going to be in the upper Midwest a lot, and we're going to be hearing from him a lot in that capacity.
What about you, Jake?
I'll take the less literal version of the question. I'm curious how aggressively he's going to prosecute the case that Joe Biden should resign the presidency. It's almost a form of like non, you know, outside the process impeachment. How hard do they really want to push that?
Yeah, it is an interesting question to me too, just because I think being president of the United States is absolutely a full-time job. It's probably well beyond a 40-hour work week. And so is running for president. And so Biden saying, I can't do two full-time jobs, I don't know that that necessarily means I can't do one full-time job, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and also I think when you vote, you know, it's like a four-year investment. You're not just thinking about today, you're thinking about 4 years from now. Well, you know, Joe Biden's got 9 months, 7 months? How much time has he got left?
Oh, gosh.
When is January?
Is it 6 months?
Until January.
Yes, he has until January of 2025. Shane, what do you think happens in the next?
J.D. is going to camp out in those three states. They're called the Democratic Blue Wall. Most famously, it collapsed back in 2016, giving Trump the presidency. Biden got that back, plus a couple more in 2020 to get him the presidency. And if you look at J.D.'s speech, he name-checked those. When I'm from Middletown, I'm from, you know, Pennsylvania. Yeah. So
that was Hannah News Service reporter Shane Stegmiller. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks.
Thanks to Andrew Tobias, State House reporter for Cleveland.com.
Happy to be here.
And Jake Zuckerman, state politics and policy reporter for Cleveland.com.
Thank you for having me on.
And thank you so much to producer Aaron Esmont Rabinowitz, who came in on Sunday with me yesterday to plan these 2 hours of All Sides. Thank you for listening on 89.7 NPR News.